failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. My name is Dean Becker, and today we'll hear from Chuck Thomas, who heads up the Interfaith Drug Policy Initiative, as well as from Chris Conrad, medical marijuana expert and reformer extraordinaire. First, Chuck Thomas.
My name is Charles Thomas from the Interfaith Drug Policy Initiative.
Tell us a little bit about your organization.
What we do is mobilize religious denominations, other large religious groups, congregations, religious leaders, individual clergy, and other people of faith to take action in support of various drug policy reform proposals. And by that we mean moving from the current punitive, coercive approach to an approach that's more compassionate and just, that treats drugs as a health issue rather than a crime.
Now, tell us, how large of an organization, how many churches or denominations are involved?
Well, what we do is we sort of act as brokers between the various religious denominations that already have supportive positions on various drug policy reform issues that are currently being considered in different legislatures. And we, in a way, act as brokers between them and the various drug policy reform groups that are spearheading various legislative campaigns, and of course the legislators themselves who need to hear about the different religious denominations' positions. To give you an example, on the mandatory minimum sentencing issue, most large major religious denominations have positions opposing mandatory minimums, and no organization, no religious denominations specifically have positions supporting mandatory minimums. The groups that oppose mandatory minimums include the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the United Methodist Church, Presbyterian Church, Evangelical Lutheran Church, and dozens of others, the four major national Black Baptist denominations, the Union for Reform Judaism, even the Prison Fellowship Ministry that's run by Chuck Colson that does conversions to evangelical Christianity in prison, they oppose mandatory minimums. So what we do is we look for the issues where there's already a lot of support from the denominations, but then on these issues, denominations have so many political positions on things that they oftentimes otherwise would be too busy to actually do anything about it. So what we do is we look and see where there's favorable bills pending or bad bills that need to be opposed, and then we contact the religious denominations with supportive positions and make it really easy for them to write letters to their legislators and otherwise take action. In the midst of all of the national concerns about methamphetamine, the some legislators took it upon themselves last fall in the context of a bill that would do a number of things, including more treatment for people with methamphetamine problems. They also added something that would create larger mandatory minimum sentences for various methamphetamine offenses. Now, when you look at the overwhelmingly negative and in some cases hysterical media coverage about this topic that's been going on for the past year or two, that seems to be the kind of climate in which a bad provision of a bill would sweep right through a legislative committee and pass on the floor and become law. But instead, this time around, the Drug Policy Alliance led efforts to get the new mandatory minimum increases taken out of the bill while it was in committee, and they asked us for some help. So we contacted all the denominations that oppose mandatory minimums and orchestrated efforts for them to directly lobby the members of the committee through a variety of means to get them to support taking out that bad new mandatory minimum piece of the bill. And ultimately, the piece of the bill was removed, so the new mandatory minimums were defeated, and the Drug Policy Alliance considers us to have been one of the most important groups in that struggle for all the politicians who are always concerned about religion and moral values and so forth, they were able to see that on this issue, on the mandatory minimum issue, the organized religion overwhelmingly is on the side of drug policy reform.
I want to talk about those who stand in support of eternal drug war. It is their policy that kicks in citizens' doors. It is their policy that ensures this black market exists. It is their policy that makes sure that overdose deaths are more likely to occur and that our children have easier access to drugs. Let's talk about the moral position of this drug war.
Absolutely. Well, we believe that it's wrong to punish or coerce anyone for what they put into their bodies unless they're doing something that directly puts another person in harm's way. But that ultimately, if someone's using drugs if someone has a problem with drugs, that should be a health issue for themselves and their families and their health care providers, and as far as their spiritual components to addiction and recovery, it should be something that people address through their faith communities or even just through their communities in general, that there are ways that people can truly help each other without needing to arrest and punish people, and that even if someone believes that any drug use is inherently immoral, it's still wrong to punish someone simply for doing something believed to be immoral. Religions have positions against all kinds of things. Various things considered sins by different denominations can include masturbation, dancing, swearing, and so forth. And no one is suggesting that people should be arrested and sent to prison for any of those things. And if you look at all the ways, as you mentioned, that the drug war actually makes things worse, that should pretty much show that, like Jesus said, is you judge a tree by its fruit. And when you look at the negative consequences of the drug war, that further shows that the drug war is wrong. Now, as far as getting organized religion to go that far, in a way, there's already some support, some recognition of alternatives. The Unitarian Universalist Association calls for a medicalized system similar to the Swiss heroin approach, and for simply treating marijuana the same way as alcohol. Other denominations and religious groups also support legal regulated markets, at least for marijuana. The Progressive Jewish Alliance, the Episcopal Diocese of New York. But as far as the major denominations go, the largest denominations, none of them at this point explicitly call for an alternative to the approach of prohibition in terms of calling for any kind of legal market. However, a number of major religious groups have positions in support of at least removing criminal penalties for people who use drugs. And these include the United Methodist Church, which is the third denomination in the country, the Presbyterian Church USA, and several others. Philadelphia Yearly Meeting of the Quakers and numerous other, even the National Council of Churches, which represents congregations from 36 denominations, they have a position going back to the early 70s supporting removing criminal penalties for marijuana possession. Unfortunately, even among the denominations that have supportive positions, there's not much impetus to really do anything about it amongst the, in a sense, the rank-and-file members. Even as far as the individual clergy are concerned, many of them don't even necessarily know their denomination's position on the issue. So in a sense, as the drug policy reform movement makes more and more progress in terms of getting viable bills introduced and initiatives and other kinds of action to at least remove criminal penalties for possession and ideally allow some sort of a regulated system of access, then we need to really turn up the heat on try to supportive denominations to really advocate for their positions on those issues and to get the other denominations to really take a more thoughtful look at drug policy and really hopefully recognize, as we talked about before, the immorality underlying the whole denominations and individual clergy and so forth really do want to get active on bills that really do have a chance of passing, or bad bills that really do have a chance of being defeated, we can really have organized religion be a major force in the efforts to have a whole sweeping overhaul of our drug laws. You know, it's certainly going to be an uphill battle. As things get closer to that, there will be denominations that dig their heels in and oppose it, and I think it'll be kind of a battle within organized religion, similar to the way the gay issue is now being hotly debated, and the abortion issue and others. Whereas up until this time, everyone has just automatically assumed that, well, drugs are bad, so of course my church must oppose drug use, and if the church opposes drug use, then of course drugs shouldn't be legal, and that's about as far as they think about it. But once we get more momentum built among denominations and really get people really having to recognize that there's a much more serious and in-depth way of looking at it, and to see that it's actually possible to consider drug use wrong, but also to consider arresting people for drugs to be wrong. You know, that's something that ultimately there'll need to be a lot of serious debate among theologians and other religious scholars and denominational leaders.
All right. We've been speaking with Charles Thomas of the Interfaith Organization. Please tell us about your website where folks might learn more.
Sure. People can go to our webpage at www.idpi.us. That's IDPI, stands for Interfaith Drug Policy Initiative.us. And on our webpage, you can read sermons opposing the drug war. You can read articles and essays and see various religious groups' positions on different issues. And there's also going to be a new book coming out published by Oxford University Press in August. By Mitch Earlywine, the author of Understanding Marijuana, and the new book is going to be about marijuana policies, and I wrote two chapters for that book about the religious group's positions on marijuana policy and various moral and theological arguments that point in a different direction.
Tens of millions of people arrested, tens of millions of families destroyed. Is the drug war a good and moral thing? I want to thank Chuck Thomas for being our guest. Next up, we hear from our good friend, Chris Conrad.
Hi, I'm Chris Conrad. I'm the director of the Family Council on Drug Awareness and a court-qualified marijuana expert in the state of California and federal court.
What's going on insofar as California? What's your observation?
Well, California has finally hit the point where I think we're starting to see the rubber hitting the road down in the San Diego area here. We've had a very interesting shift since the Raich decision last June. That was the decision in which the Supreme Court ruled that the state's law allowing for medical marijuana doesn't stop the federal government from raiding patients and caregivers here in the state. And so it had actually kind of the reverse effect that a lot of people were expecting it to have, whereas there were some what we call dispensaries. They used to be called cannabis buyers clubs, where people with doctor's approval to go to buy medical marijuana. A lot of people felt that after that case that we would see a lot of these places shut down. Instead, we've seen a very large increase in the number of them, to where there's about 150 over-the-counter locations in the state of California where a patient with a doctor's recommendation or some sort of a recognized identification card can now buy medical marijuana in California. And frankly, I really think that it was because the decision by the court was so bad that the people of California subjected it out of hand. What I mean by that is that if the Supreme Court had, the question before the Supreme Court was whether a patient who has medical necessity, a doctor's approval, in a state where medical marijuana is allowed, gets their medical marijuana and uses it without getting involved in any commercial activity, is that at least okay? Supposedly using the federal government's right to regulate interstate commerce, a local individual, no commerce at all, would that at least be okay? And the Supreme Court said, no, that's not okay either. So then it's like people here said, well, then we might as well just sell it, because that's illegal too. It's okay. Just as illegal doing it one way or the other. And so the local communities, the day after that ruling came down, the county of Alameda, California, voted to authorize three locations to sell medical marijuana. Just last couple of weeks ago, the county of Los Angeles voted to do the same thing. You know, what I'm saying is that by virtue of such a bad and obviously unjust decision and such an obvious overstepping of federal authority, so that people in California have just realized that the federal government is just completely so wrong on this that we just have to go our own way here.
Okay, Chris, this outrage, if you will, or response of the people of California has also, I think, played out nationally, where, like in the state of Rhode Island and in New Mexico, the legislators actually told the drug czar's representatives to back off, that they were making a decision on their own. Yeah, your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts on that is that this was really all settled quite some time ago in the Civil War. Actually, it was really determined a little bit before that. It was when the Runaway Slave Act was passed by the United States Congress in the 19th century, before the Civil War. That was where certain states were allowing slavery and others were not allowing slavery. And what happened was that the federal government, in that particular case that went before them, said that it doesn't matter if your state finds slavery morally reprehensible and someone escapes to your state, you still have to return them to slavery in a different state. Right now, well, what happened was that the courts went that way, but of course that's not, then it led to the repeal of that later on. There was a second case in which the court said, no, that's not right. Once a person reaches a free state, that they can stay there and be free. And so, in a sense, that's what we're looking for here in California and around the country on the medical marijuana issue, is that we're not slaves to the federal government, that we do have free states where people have rejected the criminality and the injustice of forcing people to suffer needlessly when there's a available, safe, and effective medicine for them, namely marijuana, that the federal government has gone too far. It's the same way as we said, forcing people to return to slavery when they've gotten free is not acceptable in this country. And in a sense, we've got San Diego, California, the county has asked, first they went to the federal government and they said, well, can you overturn California's law? And then it was actually pretty obvious based on their prior decisions about the Runaway Slave Act that they couldn't do that, because that set up the parallel that there's state laws and there's federal laws and that they're separate jurisdictions that they can't tell each other what to do, essentially. San Diego County has already withdrawn its federal case on that because their attorney told them not to file the case in the first place. And now they're trying to attack the constitutionality of California's medical marijuana laws here in the state courts. However, in our state constitution, it says state law and federal law are not always the same. And when there's a difference, that the state law is the one that all our state agencies are bound by. So they're facing another losing case there. So in a sense, I think what we're going to see from San Diego's attack against us on the medical marijuana community here is that it's going to further strengthen medical marijuana here in the state of California. As you mentioned, though, we've had this national backlash against the federal government on the medical marijuana policies. It hasn't stopped them from doing raids here in California, by the way, and it hasn't stopped them from taking over cases that were state cases and then refiling them as federal cases. So this separate jurisdiction is something that's very real and it's very extremely dangerous right now for people who do believe in medical rights.
There have been several instances of people up in Canada getting ensnared by U.S. drug policy. First off, I can think of is Mr. Mark Emery, who's been indicted for selling seeds to Americans. And then more recently, we've had Mr. Steve Cubby, who was arrested the moment he landed on U.S. shores. Your thoughts, sir, on the international aspect?
Well, I think each of those has a separate issue involved with it. Once you look at the situation with Mark Emery, Mr. Emery, who is a person I really greatly respect, has taken it upon himself to do the Nelson Mandela of medical marijuana, to be that kind of a person, who believes so strongly in the innate rights of human beings, some people say a God-given right, to plant green herbs and to have that as part of their life, as it says in the book of Genesis in the Bible. And though Mark Emery is not a religious person in any kind of conversation I've had with him, he does believe that we as human beings have this right to be part and parcel with nature, which means the right to grow and to use the gifts of nature, including cannabis. He has said that he's willing to do what Nelson Mandela did to, when he stood up against apartheid, as memory stands up against prohibition, and that is to do the time in prison and to become a symbol of the repression and the injustice of the drug war. Many of us hope that it doesn't come to that, and in fact, as a matter, he operated for many years with a tacit endorsement of the Canadian government in providing medical marijuana, to the extent that they were advising people to go to him. People who had doctor's approvals for medical marijuana in Canada were advised to go and get their seeds from his website. And now the same government that advised people to go to him for help is now poised to send him back to the United States. History hasn't been very good on this. If you look at the Mooring case, Americans who fled to Holland in the 1990s, they were returned to the United States and stood trial here. Mr. Nice, the hash smuggler from the 1980s and 70s, a British citizen, the United States successfully got him to come to here, stand trial in Kangaroo Court, and put him in prison for 10 years. So, you know, history doesn't look really good for Mark Emery's situation there. At the same time, you look at Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, we do see that when someone stands up for social justice and they go to prison, that oftentimes the result is that those who imprison them are shown and reduced to the criminals that they really are, and the policy itself ends up changing. And so, you know, my first hope is that Mark Emery, his own government, will shield him from this horrible injustice that I believe he would face here in the United States. And the second thing is that if they do not do that, I think this could be one of those tipping points in history where they pick the wrong person and he's willing to stand up to them and has not backed down at all in what he had to say about the wrongness of the prohibition of cannabis. And in the case of Steve Covey, you've got someone who purposefully made himself a martyr, as it were, by standing up for medical marijuana during the Proposition 215 campaign here, which is 10 years ago. This is the 10th anniversary of the mandate by the voters of California to legalize medical marijuana here. He was involved in that campaign. He later ran as a Libertarian candidate for governor. And some people think that it was an attack on him as a Libertarian candidate for governor that led to the raid at his home that eventually wind up with him not getting convicted of medical marijuana, but in fact getting convicted of possession of trace amounts of mescaline from a peyote and a psilocybin mushroom. So he actually kind of compromised in a sense, that he wasn't a purist with the marijuana. He was talking about broader prohibition issues. And so the jury convicted him on those two items, and he was given more or less a token punishment. But because of his medical necessity for marijuana, in that he has adrenal cancer, that should have killed him more than 30 years ago. And as far as they know, the only reason he's alive today is because he's been smoking a lot of marijuana constantly throughout that time period, including his recommendation up in Canada is for 1 ounce per day, which is at least four times as much as the people in the federal IND program, or about four times as much as people who get their medical marijuana from the United States government. When he fled to Canada in order to maintain his access to marijuana, something very strange happened in the interim, which was that the state legislature, his argument was that he couldn't serve time in prison in the United States because they would deprive him of the medicine he needed to survive. But the California state legislature passed a bill, SB 420, that allowed for prisoners to have access to medical marijuana. And although it hasn't really worked out that way very well in court, because the theoretical change that happened there, one of his arguments that he would be face harm of being deprived of medical marijuana, the Canadian court ruled that California law would allow him to actually have access to medical marijuana in prison. And so that was one of the things that factored against him, enabled them to deport him as they did. But basically, he chose to make himself a very public figure up in Canada. He chose to make himself a very public figure here in the United States. Since he's been back, he hasn't been given marijuana, but he has been given Marinol, and it seems to be controlling the worst part of his health problem right now. He doesn't consider it to be adequate. Only time will tell. And the unfortunate thing is that how do you know whether it's good enough until it starts showing harm, which could then be irreversible? So he's in an extremely dangerous position right now as he fights for his rights.
Chris, I know that you fight for the rights of all these people, that the millions of marijuana smokers in America and around the world who are persecuted for their use in this product, their belief that perhaps it should be a religious sacrament, or their relief when it serves their medical purposes. Any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I think that the federal government has put itself into a box that we're going to have to break it out of or force it further into one way or the other, which is this juxtapositioning between medical marijuana and religious use of marijuana. That the federal government claims there is no such thing as medical marijuana, even though they give it to people who are in the federal IND program, which is tacitly recognizing that it's not truthful. But nonetheless, under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, they said that people have the right to use their sacramental plants, in particular peyote. The Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional as far as enforcing states to allow religious use of peyote, which then could theoretically apply to cannabis, but it did not say that the federal government is not bound by its own rule. And so the feds, on the one hand, they're saying that people who use marijuana are not getting any medical benefit. At the same time, it's recognizing that there's at least seven people whose health depends upon the use of marijuana in the IND program. So then the question that comes to me is, well, does that mean it's faith healing? If they say there's no medical use there, then this isn't, in fact, a religious use. And the fact of the matter is that people who go into court, you do have a federal religious use defense. You just don't have it in state court. And so if you're charged in federal court and you're using it for medical purposes, I think that they're in a position where they have to either recognize it's got medical value and that forces them to change their policy, or else they have to say, well, then these people who are getting benefits, it must be faith healing, and therefore it becomes a religious value, and then that opens up a floodgate on the other side for them. Well, for some reason, people have not forced that issue to them. The first one to really test that, I think, is going to be Eddie Lepp, a California caregiver who uses it for spiritual and physical healing. That case is still working its way through the courts, and so we don't know where it's going to go. But I'm surprised I haven't seen a lot more cases where people are citing religious use in federal court who are trying to use it medically, because, you know, you recognize that under the Supreme Court ruling last year, your medical argument is not very strong, but your religious argument is still strong.
We've been speaking with Mr. Chris Conrad. He's the co-author of Shattered Lives and very active in trying to educate this nation about the need for change. Do you have a website you'd like to send folks to?
Sure. Let me recommend three. The first is my homepage, chrisconrad.com. The second is safeaccessnow.net, fundamentally a medical marijuana site, and then which has a downloadable booklet that I really recommend for people. It's called Cannabis Yields and Dosage, which will explain medical marijuana in a way that probably you haven't heard it before that's very clear. And the third one is a portal site that links to many different other sites, including religious use, medical use, etc., and that's called Equal Rights, the digit 4, awe.org.
Marijuana heals thousands of our kids every day. Drugs are just bad. Okay?
Please educate yourself, embolden yourself by visiting our website, which is endprohibition.org. There you can link to about 15 of the best drug reform organizations on the planet. Once again, I remind you, there is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, medical data, in fact, no reason for this drug war to continue. We've been duped. The drug lords run both sides of this equation. Please do your part to end this madness. Prohibido istak ivalesco.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Guffey.